G.K. Chesterton once commented that it was always easier to forgive an injury than an insult. I think, generally speaking, he's right. Of course, not all the slurs and the snubs we receive go very deep. I got a mouthful the other day from a gentleman in Adam Brooks' car park. Seems I had taken a parking space to which he felt he owned freehold title. But I found a steely glare and a sympathetic smile was sufficient to maintain my self-esteem in the situation, in spite of his rather uncomplimentary remarks. When it comes to the public defamation of our character, we can always sue for libel if we want, don't we? And almost feel indebted to the person who insults us in that situation when they pay us damages for it. And then, of course, not all insults are intentional. Some are not intended at all, like the person who accused me in the church vestibule the other week of being an Australian. I'm sure the individual concerned bore no malice to me at all. It was an example of transatlantic innocence. An American who didn't understand either our accents or our colonial history. And though the slight did cut very deep, was it necessary to harbour any grudge? Some people, of course, have the habit, don't they, of making those kinds of tactless remarks. But then, of course, there are some insults which are different. Some insults which are deliberate, premeditated, calculated to hurt. I shall never forget being shown a letter written by a daughter to her mother. It was just about the most concentrated verbal vitriol I think I've ever read. It broke that mother's heart. In fact, it came quite close to putting you in a mental institution. If the daughter had spat in her face publicly, she couldn't have been more profoundly humiliated. When I was a child in the playground, our response to that kind of oral malice was, "Sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me." But the bluff is as poor as the rhyme, isn't it? For names do hurt. Cruel words have the capacity to draw our tears and to prey on our mind in a way that no physical blow ever could. Now, Chesterton's right when he says it's often easier to forgive an injury than an insult. And maybe some of us here have experiences brought to our mind as I speak that confirm that. Maybe you've been hurt by insults. Well, if so, you're going to be able to empathize this morning with our Bible study in a very special way. For today's passage in Luke 20 tells what I can justly claim to be the biggest, the most injurious, the most shameless insult ever administered in the entire history of the world. That's why I've called it the ultimate insult. For no other insult has ever demonstrated more brazen impertinence or left such permanent scars. This ultimate insult was delivered not just against a human being, but against the loving heart of God himself. And Jesus tells us about it in this passage in a story. Well, I say a story. A parable is not an ideal term for this particular story. Parables usually have only one point to make. This story is almost an allegory. It's certainly less cryptic than many of Jesus' other stories, his parables. One doesn't need to be a particularly shrewd person to interpret its meaning. It's so obvious, even unsympathetic listeners, we're told, were left in no doubt about what Jesus was getting at. Perhaps it's because of this unusual degree of transparency that this particular parable is so particularly poignant. I want us to look at it in three parts. First, in verses 9 to 12, I want us to ask the question, what did Jesus think of the world? Because the story answers that, and it sets the scene for the insult I'm speaking about. Then in verses 13 to 15, I want us to ask, what did Jesus think of himself and his own mission? It's this section of the story that shocks us with the insult itself. And then in verses 16 to 18, I want us to ask the question, what did Jesus think of the future? For this final part of the story tells us the consequences of the insult. First of all, then, what did Jesus think of the world? verses 9 to 12. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time he sent a servant to the tenants, so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another, but that one also they beat. He sent a third. They wounded him too, and threw him out. Now, if you look back to the beginning of this chapter, to verse 1, you'll see that Jesus told this story in the context of an inquisition that was being conducted against him by the chief priests and the teachers of the law. His long journey to Jerusalem was at last complete, as we've said. He'd entered the city, and he'd done so, we read in the previous chapter, amid a triumphant procession of his followers. And no sooner had he arrived than he caused a minor sensation by throwing all the merchants out of the temple. So it wasn't surprising that the Jewish hierarchy should feel some kind of official inquiry was necessary. Hence their loaded question in verse 2. Tell us by what authority you're doing these things. Who gave you this authority? But I want you to notice that Jesus refuses to answer their interrogation directly. Instead, he asks a loaded question of his own. Tell me, John's baptism, was it from heaven or from men? He asks. And while they are still fumbling to think of a diplomatic answer to that one, he proceeds to tell this story we've just read. A story which, according to verse 19 at the very end of our passage, his inquisitors were quite sure was directed against them. And I don't think that was any paranoia on their part. It was directed against them. For anyone familiar with the Old Testament would immediately realize that this picture of the vineyard that Jesus is using was not original to him. It derives from the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 5. In that passage of the prophet Isaiah, the prophet composes a song on very similar lines to Jesus' parable here. In fact, if you were to read Mark's account of this story, he practically quotes from Isaiah 5 verbatim as he tells it. I will sing a song to the one whom I love, a song about his vineyard, chants Isaiah. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for it? Yet when I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. And here's the key verse. For the vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel. The men of Judah are the garden of his delight. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed. Isaiah's song was far too famous, and the parallels with Jesus' parable far too many for the implication to be lost on these Jewish Bible scholars in his audience. The vineyard of which Jesus was speaking was the same the prophet Isaiah spoke of. It was Israel, the people of God. And these wicked tenants, to whom Jesus attributes the blame for the vineyard's unproductiveness, well, one doesn't need huge imagination to realize that they represent Israel's leaders, the very chief priests and teachers of the law who were trying to discredit Jesus at that moment. Those of you who have been following this series, you may remember that pungent attack Jesus made on precisely these same Jewish religious establishment figures back in chapter 11. Woe to you, teachers of the law, he said. You build tombs for the prophets, but it was your forefathers who killed them. You testify that you approve what your forefathers did. They killed the prophets, you build their tombs. Because of this, God said in his wisdom, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill, and others they will persecute. Well, it's this strange divine strategy of sending prophets who will be killed that Jesus is allegorizing here in his story. The people of God have refused to yield the fruit of righteousness which God required of them. And on top of that, they have cruelly rejected his servants the prophets whenever he has sent them to them. The danger for us, of course, is that recognizing the immediate reference of this story was to first century Israel and its leaders, we can be tempted to evade its implications for us, can't we? We can say to ourselves, so it was those smug Pharisees that Jesus is condemning, was it? Oh, thank God we're not like those smug Pharisees. We're not among these wicked tenants he speaks about, are we? But that would be a disastrous mistake. For this parable of Jesus is no mere limited tale. Its relevance to Israel in the first century AD is its relevance too to us. Just as the song of Isaiah, which Jesus is expounding, though spoken originally in the 8th century BC, which he felt was relevant to his day. But this is a story, really, of privilege abused, of generosity despised, of responsibility shirked. And understood that way, it speaks to the human race generally. Luke certainly didn't include it in his gospel in order to foster anti-Semitic prejudice amongst his Gentile readers. No, he included it because he knew it was relevant to them, as indeed it is to us 20 centuries later. Jesus is not just describing Israel here, even if they are the primary reference. When he speaks of a vineyard, he's speaking of the whole world. A world originally created by God, full of productive potential. What was it Genesis says? God put Adam in the garden to till it and keep it. So what's gone wrong with the world, Jesus? Why have things turned out so sour? Why are our hopes for a better world so elusive? Why is that idyllic Eden nothing but a tantalizing dream in our racial memory? What's gone wrong in the vineyard? Is it, as some would say, that we haven't yet evolved from our animal origin sufficiently to cooperate harmoniously in tending the vines? Is it that our technology is too primitive? Do we need to update our production methods with fertilizers and mechanization and then everything will be all right? Is it the vicious socio-economic system to which we're victim with its oppressive absentee landlords and its exploited wage labourers seething with class antagonism? Now, according to Jesus, the problem of the world is quite simple. Men were put in the vineyard as tenants, but they want to be owners. See what we read in verse 14? Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. The thing about a tenant, of course, is that he is accountable to somebody. He owes the rent. And Jesus is saying here, the same is true of us human beings. We are accountable too. We owe a debt of moral obedience to the God who made us and gave us this beautiful world to live in. That's why, of course, we have the word ought in our vocabulary. Originally, the word ought was part of the verb to owe. It's the word of moral obligation, of moral debt. All human beings intuitively recognize the relevance of the word ought. What I want to do, that's pleasure. What it's easiest to do, that's expediency. What I must do, that's coercion. What I ought to do, that's morality. And that last influence upon our choices, we instinctively feel, has some kind of unquestionable priority, don't we? No matter how painful it is, no matter what inconvenience it may involve, no matter how many people are trying to force me to do the opposite, if this is what I ought to do, then I ought to do it. The question that has occupied philosophers ever since men began to think is, where does this extraordinary sense of moral obligation derive from? And of course, increasingly these days, people want to relate it to mere social conditioning, don't they? Morals are just conventions which society teaches us in our infancy and which we internalize in the form of a conscience. But the trouble is, you see, once you really believe that, then all morals immediately lose their cogency. If right and wrong are just social conventions, why shouldn't I break them if I want to? The answer is no reason at all. This modern sociological analysis of the word ought doesn't so much explain our sense of moral obligation as explain it away. You know, the distinctive thing about the word ought is that it feels as if it comes to me from outside, from some higher authority. And the trouble with the humanistic philosophies that have dominated the West since 1600 or 1700 is that they have no access to such a higher authority. They want moral law, but without a lawgiver. They want absolute values without an absolute person. You can't, you see. Responsibility, by definition, involves two parties, not one. Imperatives can only be expressed in the second person. You have to be able to answer the question, responsibility to whom? And humanism can't. But Jesus can. It's the owner of the vineyard, he says. Man's moral nature is a reflection of the fact that we are on this earth as tenants, not owners. We owe God something. There is an ought built into our human existence. And the reason the vineyard's a mess is because man for centuries has been trying to run away from that accountability. You can be a god too if you want to, the devil told Adam. And in his megalomaniac pride, he believed him. He chose the path of moral defiance rather than moral obedience. That's why I say the Jews' rejection of the law and the prophets is not essentially different from man's rejection of God generally. Paul puts it in his great epistle to the Romans like this. He says, deep down, every one of us, Jew or Gentile, we know enough of our responsibility to God to worship him and submit to him. If we're Jews, we've got a Bible. If we're Gentiles, we've got a conscience. What nobody has is an excuse. We all know we are tenants. We all know we're in arrears with the rent. And when the owner steps into our lives to remind us of that debt we owe, our instinctive reaction, therefore, is not one of surprise, but of resistance. He sent a servant so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard, but they beat him and sent him away empty-handed. So Jesus tells us it was Israel's unilateral declaration of independence from God that put the prophets on the gallows. And he would have us realize that it's precisely the same kind of arrogant bid for moral autonomy that has led to the failure of all our secular visions for a better world, too. Man has a power complex, like an incompetent actor. He's determined to play Hamlet, determined to play God. And he's incapable of being humble enough to recognize such a role is too big for him. The ingratitude of it is bad enough. That God should bestow all this privilege and dignity on us human beings, such potential for creative endeavor, and that we human beings should be so little willing to render anything back to God. But it's the futility of it which is even more pathetic. For this is a rebellion that's doomed to failure. The insane insolence of it. The puny creatures should wave their fists at omnipotence, rejecting everybody that God sends to remind them of the debt they owe him. He's not going to tolerate that, is he? That succession of insults? The extraordinary thing is he tolerates it so long. And that brings us to the second movement of the story. What Jesus thought of his own mission. Look at verse 13. Then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him. There's a pathos about that soliloquy, isn't there? It's intensely moving. Here Jesus portrays the patience of God, who has provided rebel human beings with one opportunity after another for repentance, only to find himself permanently and repeatedly slapped in the face. But still he desires to show mercy. Still, he will offer one last chance, even though it means gambling with the most precious thing he has, my son, my beloved. But we mustn't allow the emotional power of that verse to obscure from us the vital theological implication it carries. Remember the demand that had provoked this parable. Tell us by what authority you are doing these things, the chief priests and lawyers had demanded. Well, it's hard to escape the conclusion that here in verse 13, Jesus is giving a pretty straight answer to that. I will send my son, whom I love. If there's any doubt in our minds that Jesus is introducing himself as a character in his story at this point, it's surely dissolved by the addition of that qualifying phrase, whom I love. Because that's the very word that came from heaven when Jesus was baptized by John. And Luke has told us about it in Luke chapter 3. You are my son, said the voice from heaven as he came out of the water. Whom I love. The coincidence is just too great, especially when you recall that Jesus has just made a direct reference to the baptism of John in verse 3 of this very chapter. Now, there can be no missing Jesus' assertion. The prophets who came before were servants. I am the Son. I'm not a rabbi, not even a prophet. I'm the Messiah, the Son of God. Jesus is confessing here a unique filial consciousness. And it's by virtue of that divine sonship that I exercise the authority I do, he says. Perhaps, says God, they will respect him. And he makes the same wistful comment, perhaps, as he looks down on our congregation this morning. Perhaps they will respect him. I know it's irritating to modern liberal minds to say one religion is better than another. In our pluralist generation, all the pressures are upon us to put Jesus into some less exclusive category. A prophet, a genius, a philosopher, a guru, call him something like that. But flattering though titles like that are, there's nothing unique about them, is there? We can admire people like that without following them. We can even ignore them if we want. But Jesus will not allow us to damn him with faint praise in that way. He claims here to be God's last resort, his final word, his beloved son. And if he's right about that, we've got to respect him. We have no choice. The awful truth is we didn't. When the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said. Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. There are many dimensions, of course, to the cross. And that perhaps is why we have to make it into a visual symbol. There are far too many facets to its significance for us to possibly encapsulate them all in a few words. But in this parable, Jesus is focusing down on just one element in the significance of the cross. The cross, he says, is the ultimate insult. The last in a long line of insults. And the most unforgivable. The cross is man's final gesture of contempt for the rule of God over his life, he says. The cross is the final snub. We would not tolerate anybody who called us so authoritatively to recognize our accountability to our Maker. So we crucified him. Once again, it's all too easy for us to shelter behind the fact that Jesus was addressing Jews in this parable. Oh yes, we say it was all their fault. The Jews, the Romans, barbaric they were. It was an appalling judicial murder, I quite agree. When I watched Ben-Hur last Christmas, my eyes were wet with tears at the injustice of it all. But no, we dare not isolate ourselves from blame in that way. To do so isn't to engage with this parable at all, but to run away from it. The whole point of what Jesus is saying is that we are tenants. We were there when they crucified the Lord. Where were you? With the religious establishment, perhaps? This man's unsound. Better got rid of. Could it be that some of us are like that, so wedded to our tradition, so wedded to our right doctrine, so blind to the real meaning of the scriptures, though we know them so well, that we couldn't recognize the Son of God when he came? Or with the Roman authorities, those politicized pragmatists? Oh no, not another Jewish Messiah. Better let Caiaphas have his way, or we'll all lose our jobs. Would some of us be with them, vainly trying to wash our hands of the business, more concerned about our careers and justice? Or with the soldiers, perhaps? Sadistic men of violence? Oi, Joe, we can have a bit of fun with this one. He says he's a king, would you believe? Or with the disciples? Judas, who loved 30 pieces of silver more than his master? Or Peter, who was too much of a coward to own up to the fact that he was a Christian in the critical hour? Oh yes, we're not the stuff of which martyrs are made, are we? Or with the crowd, perhaps? That's where most of us would have been, isn't it? Statistics dictate that. That vast, mindless herd. I don't know whether you saw the cartoon at the time of the Brixton riots in one of the newspapers. There was a teenage lad coming across a gang of youths pelting the police with stones. "Cool, this is great," he said, picking up a handy missile and joining in the fray. "What's it all about?" And that's what mob violence is always like, isn't it? A spontaneous relief of frustration and pent-up feeling. No one really stops to think out whether the person getting hurt is really to blame or not. It's just a great emotional catharsis to get in a crowd and shout. 50 years ago, it was Heil Hitler. A few years ago in Notting Hill, it was Out Black. 2 or 3 years ago in Brixton, it was Fascist Pig. On that first Good Friday, it was crucify him. Crucify him. Yes, we would have been there somewhere, you see. It's awful, I know, to think that people like us could crucify anybody, but we could. And in a very real sense, we did. For we are part of the conspiracy. We have talked the matter over. This is the heir. Let's kill him. It's not that our hands were the actual hands that drove the nails through his body, but that our hearts are guilty enough to do it. Oh, we can plead ignorance. In fact, Jesus himself pleaded it for us. "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing," he prayed. But this parable exposes the generosity of Jesus' prayer and the shallowness of any such excuse. For this parable insists that if we crucified him in ignorance, it was nevertheless culpable ignorance. These tenants knew only too well who it was they were murdering and why they were doing it. Then the inheritance will be ours. And Jesus would have us know, deep down at the profoundest level of our personal honesty, we know that too. We know who he is, and we know why we don't want him in our lives. It's that obsessive desire for independence, isn't it? That lunatic ambition to play God. I don't want any patronizing deity interfering with my life. I want to do my thing. I want to be my own master. This is the heir. Let's kill him. That the inheritance may be ours. And we've all said it. And every time we've said it, we add our personal nail to those that held Jesus on the cross. And that brings us to the last movement of the story. What Jesus thought of the future. a future dictated by such an insult. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He asked. He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. I think one of the most moving missionary books I've ever read has to be Don Richardson's story, The Peace Child. In the 1960s, Don Richardson worked among primitive peoples in West Irian on the island of New Guinea. And as he learned their languages, he discovered an extraordinary tribal custom which eventually provided him with a vital key to sharing the gospel with them. He learned that when relationships between two neighboring tribes on the island were in a state of tension, it was their practice to exchange live babies. It's a kind of peace treaty. In fact, they called these infants involved in the transaction peace children. So long as that peace child lived and was cared for by its alien host, peace would be guaranteed between the two tribes. Well, Richardson quickly saw the relevance of this idea of a peace child to the Christian message, and was eager to explain it to the tribal elders. And that's when I think the most touching moment in his book occurs. Richardson is saying, Miai Kodon, that is the greatest spirit, his word for God, Miai Kodon knew beforehand that men would despise and kill the peace child he sent to them, that Miai Kodon loved us so much that he gave his son freely, nevertheless. As he speaks those words, he tells us he was about to develop the argument further, but was interrupted by an anguished murmuring from Hato, who was one of the tribal patriarchs. He says as he looked at his face, it was startling in its sorrow. And Hato's son, Amio, explained why. Not long before you came, he said, my father gave a peace child to the Kayaga tribe. They took the baby, but did not give one in return. Amio winced as he continued. Later we heard they had killed the baby and cannibalized it. Richardson tells us how horrified he was and how he struggled to come to terms with these stunning revelations. And then old Hato's voice came softly through the silence, this old, old chief. And he said to Richardson, I suppose Miai Kodon must have felt sad too, just like me. Now Jesus, here in this parable, is inviting us to enter into the heart of God, just as old Hato did at that moment. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He asks. In other words, put yourself in God's place. Feel with him the trauma of this situation, the emotions of a father whose only son has been murdered by ungrateful renegades. Feel the sadness, feel the personal loss, feel the disappointment and the frustration. But, says Jesus, feel too the anger, the indignation. What will the owner of the vineyard do? Can we expect indifference to such an outrage? To such an insult? No, says Jesus. He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. For the Jews, listening, of course, this was a devastating prophecy that their title to the kingdom of God would be forfeit, that their temple, their nation, would be taken from them by Gentiles, by others. No wonder they said, may this never be. It tore the stuffing out of their messianic utopianism. It meant that for them, the coming of the Messiah would not be a day of national triumph at all, but a day of national catastrophe. But just as it would have been foolish of us to think the only wicked tenants in this world are Jews, so it would be an even greater folly to assume the only people God is angry with in this world are Jews. No, it's the solemn prospect of judgment to come that Jesus confronts all of us with at the end of his story. So all of us are tenants. All of us are accountable. And all of us, he says, will give account. Jesus looked directly at them and asked, "What then is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone." To us, that's a cryptic verse, but to Luke's readers, it made eminent sense. They knew all about this verse. There's a messianic prophecy from the Old Testament. Speaks about a stone which the masons, perhaps building the temple, found, but discarded at first because it seemed the wrong shape. Then when they got to the very top of the building, they realized this was the very unique piece of rock they needed to form the very supporting arch, the capstone, the chief cornerstone, the piece of rock without which the whole edifice would collapse. In its original setting, it probably applies to the king of Israel, whom the pagan nations despised, but whom God had raised from a worthless pebble to be exalted over his enemies. The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. But to the Jews of Jesus' day, this was a messianic prophecy. And Jesus points out to them the full significance of the words. God's Messiah will be rejected and then exalted, he says. The scriptures say so. My story of the rejected son is confirmed by the scripture you know so well about the rejected stone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, he says. But he on whom it falls will be crushed. It is a dangerous thing, then, to reject the Son of God. You're playing with fire, he says. Put yourself in God's place and you'll realize why. Do you really think God is going to tolerate the preposterous insolence of us human beings forever? Faced with such an ultimate insult? No. A day of accounting is coming. What you do with me, the stone you builders reject, what you do with me determines your destiny. Do you notice that phrase Jesus introduces verse 17 with? Jesus looked directly at them. He gripped them with his eyes. This was important. What was in that look? Urgency, appeal. Can't you sense his eyes fixed on you in just the same way right now? All the love of God for us stupid, wayward, sinful people is concentrated in that gaze. What will the owner of the vineyard do to them? Don't say it couldn't happen to me. For we were there too. With all those other rebellious tenants, we were part of the conspiracy. We were there when they crucified the Lord. We can't plead innocent. Jesus would have us know that we are part of a cosmic insult directed at the heart of our Creator. He is waiting now for our apology. And he doesn't intend to wait forever. Let's pray together.